Good evening and welcome to the KRFP Evening Report for Thursday, June 12th, 2025. I'm Lee Robartis in the news tonight. Spokane City Council President Ben Stuckart is out of jail after police arrested him yesterday for trying to block illegal deportation in downtown Spokane. Attempted blockade drew 1,000 protesters and police using smoke grenades and apparently rubber bullets. Trump declares sweeping agreement between Northwest Tribes, Oregon, and the federal government on salmon habitat that would have diverted lawsuit for 10 years is null and void. Republican senators propose declaring federal land surplus in numerous states, including Idaho, putting them up for sale. Interstate 84 is open again in Columbia Gorge after wildfire closure yesterday. We'll have details on those stories and more coming up on the KRFP Evening Report. And live in the KRFP studios in Moscow, Idaho, I'm Lee Robartis, and this is the KRFP Evening Report. Spokane City Council President Ben Stuckart is out of jail after police arrested him yesterday for trying to block the illegal abduction of two immigrants, one from Venezuela and one from Colombia, who had valid work permits and were in the process of applying for asylum. The detention led to a protest with 1,000 people in downtown Spokane near an ICE processing center that city and county police attacked with smoke grenades and less lethal projectiles. Stuckart posted on his Facebook page today, "Spokane shows up. I am out of jail. Up until I was arrested, the protest was 99.9% peaceful. Not sure what happened that led to the use of pepper spray. I was peacefully detained before any of that went down. Unfortunately, Cesar and Josuar were taken by ICE to Tacoma. They were illegally detained, had work permits, and had gone through every single correct procedure and only showed up at the ICE office to follow the rules. They have been following the rules. They are good, upstanding young men. Those that judge my actions harshly are on the wrong side of history. What is happening is wrong. These two young men were not criminals and were following the law. I have much privilege and I am able to protest and be arrested. Many others in our community need us to stand up for them. They are not in a position to do this. It is our moral responsibility to stand for them." Spokane Mayor Lisa Brown issued a curfew starting at 9:30 p.m. last night for a crowd of anti-deportation demonstrators in Riverfront Park and nearby downtown streets. Two demonstrations merged after protesters blocked Immigration and Customs Enforcement vehicles from leaving an unmarked ICE facility north of Riverfront Park, possibly containing innocent people taken into custody. Police arrested more than 30 people. Police deployed what appeared to be tear gas, but what Spokane Police Chief Kevin Hall said was smoke grenades against the demonstrators in Riverfront Park. Hall said some of the 185 officers who responded to the event fired pepper balls but did not fire rubber bullets. Mayor Brown said, "We want everybody to be safe, and we thought this was the best path forward in order to achieve that. I made the decision that the safest course of action was by Spokane Police, not ICE, to try to safely disperse the crowd." Police Chief Hall said, "Certainly there were peaceful folks demonstrating and utilizing their First Amendment rights, and there were also people in the crowd who were committing crimes." Events escalated after Spokane City Council President Ben Stuckart wrote on social media at about 1 p.m. yesterday that he was at an unmarked ICE processing facility on Cataldo Street in the downtown area. Stuckart wrote, quote, "If you care at all about these illegal detainers, you meet me at 411 West Cataldo by 2 p.m. I am going to set in front of the bus. Feel free to join me. The Latino community needs the rest of our community. Not tonight, not Saturday, but right now." About 75 people initially joined him, including Spokane County Democratic Party Chair Nida Spencer, Democratic State Representative Tim Ormsby, Spokane City Council candidate Sarah Dixit, union advocate and former Democratic candidate for several offices Ted Cummings, Thrive International Director Mark Finney, and Latinos in Spokane Director Jennifer Mesa. While some carried signs and chanted or just observed, others sat on the ground in front of a white bus in an attempt to prevent federal agents from transporting the two young men to the Northwest Detention Center in Tacoma. Council President Stuckert told the Spokesman Review yesterday afternoon the demonstration began after immigration agents apprehended 21-year-old Venezuelan Cesar Alexander Alvarez Perez, who is seeking asylum, and Colombian Joshua Slater Rodriguez Torres, who is in his early 20s. Stuckert said he became the Venezuelan's legal guardian 3 weeks ago. He said he was with Alvarez Perez and Rodriguez Torres when they arrived at a scheduled check-in at the Spokane facility yesterday morning. The two had work visas and are full-time employees at the Airway Heights Walmart. He said the federal government revoked the men's work permits on Friday, 7 minutes after ICE officials would not let Stuckert enter the facility with Alvarez Perez. One of the officers came out of the building and told Stuckert they had detained the two men. Stuckert told the Spokesman Review, each of them has a stack of legal paperwork at least 2 inches thick with all their asylum paperwork and their guardianship paperwork, and they clearly didn't look at it. They just said, we're detaining them, Stuckert said yesterday afternoon before he was arrested. You can't help spend time with them and not understand just what great young men they are. They've done everything right, and they're escaping horrible situations. And then to have them come in for a checkup and be detained illegally is morally reprehensible. I don't want this bus to leave with my friends, and I told everybody I was down here, and if people wanted to join me, they could. It's not right. It's not morally right what's happening. After uniformed federal agents came out of the building to warn the protesters they could be arrested for obstructing their fellow agents, protesters parked their vehicles in front of and behind the bus. The Spokesman Review reported that around 5:30 p.m., the crowd of protesters had grown and about 150 people went to the back of the building to obstruct three unmarked law enforcement vehicles from leaving a fenced-in parking area. They repeatedly yelled shame, and about 10 people linked arms in a line in front of the parking lot gate. A number of agents in ski masks and sunglasses pushed against the human chain, knocking glasses off their faces and causing them to scatter their handmade signs. There was a shoving match for a minute before the agents retreated. After that, a few protesters brought lime scooters and park benches to create a barricade to block the ICE vehicles. About a dozen Spokane police and Spokane County Sheriff's deputies arrived, who formed a barrier to enable federal agents to exit on a side of the building. The police carried less lethal munitions and what appeared to be tear gas canisters. Another group of officers began forcibly removing the protesters around the bus and then gave a warning over a SWAT car speaker that they had 5 minutes to leave. Police then arrested about a dozen protesters who remained after 7:30 p.m. Police then arrested about 15 people who surrounded an unmarked red van with tinted windows that protesters said may contain the detained immigrants. One of those arrested was City Council President Ben Stuckert. After that, people deflated the tires of the red van. Later, there was a previously planned anti-deportation protest nearby in Riverfront Park, which swelled to an estimated 1,000 people. Police shot what appeared to be tear gas and rubber bullets at the protesters. 23-year-old protester Harris Kaler told the Spokesman Review he was standing on the front line when police shot the ground in front of the protesters with paint guns. Police threw smoke canisters, and Kaler said he kicked one back. He went to get another one, and police shot him in the back with a rubber bullet. He said, "I'm in a lot of pain, but if I physically have to be here, I'll be the shield I got to be." In response to the incident, conservative Spokane City Council member Jonathan Bingle said in a phone interview, "The moment a protest turns into small vandalism, threats, or lawlessness, it is no longer protected speech. It becomes a crime and should be dealt with as such. I am stunned by the position of some of our current and former elected officials in our city. Instead of standing for the rule of law and the officers who keep our streets safe, they seem more interested in scoring points or justifying bad behavior. That is not leadership." Liberal council member Paul Dillon said, "No human being is illegal. This is a direct result of the escalation and fears the Trump administration inflicts on communities which create chaos." The spokesman review reported Mayor Brown's curfew had its intended effect, and by 11 p.m., only about 20 protesters remained. You tuned into the KRFP Evening Report. This is KRFP Moscow Pullman. Seattle Police Chief Sean Barnes says he expects to be jailed in the future by federal government officials as the top person in the Seattle Police Department. According to the Seattle Times, Barnes made the comment Tuesday as part of his confirmation process, adding the possibility of his arrest is a repercussion of his belief he stands up in support of all Seattle residents. Barnes said his comment was in response to the intergovernmental standoff at the protests in Los Angeles this week, where Trump ordered immigration raids by federal troops and the National Guard. Barnes referenced the back-and-forth sniping between Trump and California Governor Gavin Newsom and the recent arrest of a Wisconsin judge. He said, "I will do everything in my power to protect anyone in Seattle from anyone who comes to this city with the intention to hurt them or inhibit their First Amendment rights. What that means is that at some point I will probably go to jail and be in prison because we have an administration that has threatened to jail politicians and indeed has done so in Milwaukee and has threatened to jail a governor." The Seattle City Council has not yet confirmed Barnes as the new police chief. He came to Seattle from Madison, Wisconsin, after Mayor Bruce Harrell nominated him as Seattle's new police chief. Tuesday's Public Safety Committee meeting was the first step in the confirmation process, which is expected to continue into next week. Barnes' work orders include addressing increased gun violence, retaining employees, and bolstering the number of police department workers through improved recruitment practices. Barnes pointed to the Constitution as his base, especially in light of a clash between protesters against anti-LGBTQ plus evangelical Christians from Spokane who held a rally in Cal Anderson Park in Seattle last month. Protesters met the anti-gay group and police intervened. Several days later, a second rally near City Hall occurred, but police had set up barricades to keep the groups separated. According to the report, some Seattle elected officials and progressives criticized police tactics protecting the Christian group. Barnes said police personnel must stay neutral on these issues. He said, "We're not on the side of anyone but the Constitution." Barnes also said the department currently does not ask people about their immigration status and will not in the future. He said the department would not cooperate with immigration officers. He said, "If the day comes that the federal government gives me an order to cooperate or help with that, I will politely tell them that that is not something that we do. It is clear to me that our federal administration, they don't define justice the way we define it in Seattle, and that's why we have a dual system of justice in this country." In a presidential memorandum issued today, Donald Trump ordered members of his cabinet to withdraw from a memorandum of agreement between the Biden administration and Columbia River Basin tribes that pledged significant investments in salmon recovery and could have laid the groundwork for breaching the four lower Snake River dams. The agreement between the Biden administration and the Columbia River Basin tribes exchanged a pause in salmon versus dams litigation in exchange for salmon recovery investments and a series of studies on the best way to replace the hydropower, irrigation, and commodity transportation made possible by the dams. The deal was expected to bring more than $1 billion in federal investments to help recover wild fish in the Snake and Columbia rivers. The agreement would pause the litigation for 10 years. Trump said in the memorandum today, "My administration is committed to protecting the American people from radical green agenda policies that make their lives more expensive and to maximizing the beneficial uses of our existing energy infrastructure and natural resources to generate energy and lower the cost of living." In September of 2023, former President Biden called for a sustained national effort to honor treaty commitments to the Nez Perce and other tribes by restoring snake and Columbia River salmon and steelhead to healthy and abundant levels. Today, Trump rescinded the executive order. According to the Lewiston Tribune website, Nez Perce tribe chair Shannon Wheeler said, "This action tries to hide from the truth. The Nez Perce tribe holds a duty to speak the truth for the salmon, and the truth is that extinction of salmon populations is happening now. People across the Northwest know this, and people across the nation have supported us in a vision for preventing salmon extinction that would, at the same time, create a stronger and better future for the Northwest." Northwest Public Power Association Executive Director Kurt Miller said in a news release, "Keeping the dams provides a lifeline for the Northwest's clean energy economy and its most vulnerable families. Withdrawing from the agreement means the issue will surely return to federal court, where litigants have battled for more than 30 years. In the federal case, the salmon advocates have succeeded in convincing federal judges that the federal government's plan for salmon recovery is inadequate to protect the 13 runs of threatened and endangered salmon and steelhead, including 4 runs that return to the Snake River and its tributaries in Idaho, Washington, and northeastern Oregon." According to the Northwest Power and Conservation Council, as many as 16 million wild fish returned to the Columbia River Basin annually prior to 1850, and the overexploitation of the runs by commercial fishing along with habitat damage followed by development of the hydropower system. In the 1990s, that number dropped to 1.3 million. Over the past 20 years, the return has climbed to 2.3 million. Today, most returning fish are from hatcheries, and Snake River wild chinooks, steelhead, sockeye, and fall chinook are all protected under the Endangered Species Act. Scientists have argued the dams, which have fish ladders for adults and sophisticated fish bypass systems for juveniles, pose a significant source of mortality. In 2022, the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration said dam breaching is required to restore the runs to abundance. According to multiple studies, breaching would benefit the fish, but it would also end tug and barge transportation on the Lower Snake River and reduce the amount of electricity the federal hydropower system generates. When the Nez Perce and other tribes of the Lower Columbia River Basin signed the treaties with the federal government, the agreements enshrined in the Constitution protected their rights to fish for salmon at usual and accustomed places. The tribes argue the dams are driving the fish that are central to their culture, well-being, religion, and economies to extinction and amount to a breach in their treaty rights. Trout Unlimited President Chris Wood said the history of salmon recovery in the Northwest has been driven by court orders and regulations, and what made that agreement unique is that it was collaborative in nature. I think it's unfortunate we are not going to give that a shot to work. What it will do is drive people back to the courtroom, and I don't know how many salmon have been recovered as a result of court orders, but I know there has been a tremendous amount of social and economic dislocation as a result of that approach. Congressional Republicans have revived plans to sell federal public lands as part of ongoing negotiations on the federal budget reconciliation bill, including Idaho's public lands. Republican U.S. Senator Mike Lee of Utah, who is chair of the Senate Energy and Natural Resources Committee, introduced legislation yesterday that would mandate the sale of large tracts of public land after officials with the Trump administration deemed them eligible for disposal. The parcels are in Alaska, Arizona, California, Colorado, Idaho, Nevada, New Mexico, Oregon, Utah, Washington, and Wyoming. Senator Lee is proposing the U.S. government sell up to 3.29 million acres of public land and says income from the sales would help meet revenue goals in the federal budget. The land sales could have a significant impact on tribal nations who could lose what until now has been guaranteed access to cultural sites and ancestral lands. A number of tribes opposed an earlier land sale amendment, which included parcels directly adjacent to reservations. The tribes say the federal government did not consult with them about the legislation beforehand. In a press release, Shivwitz Band of Paiutes said the bill is a furtive attempt that ignores tribal sovereignty. The Paiutes say the tribe unequivocally opposes the legislation. Idaho Conservation League Conservation Director Brad Smith said, "Idahoans and Americans cherish their public lands for recreation, hunting, fishing, camping, and more. These are the places we take our families camping. It's where you catch a cutthroat trout or go hiking with your kids. These lands belong to all of us, and we must keep them that way." Republican U.S. Representative Mike Simpson of Idaho's 2nd Congressional District worked to strip the land sale provision from the House bill. Republican U.S. Representative Russ Fulcher, who represents Idaho's 2nd Congressional District, voted in support of the measure. The bill excludes Montana, where the state's congressional delegation has been united in opposing proposals to sell or transfer public lands. Republican U.S. Representative Ryan Zinke of Montana was instrumental in removing a similar provision from the House version of the bill. Smith said, "We hope Senators Risch and Crapo will stand with Representative Simpson and Montana's delegation in opposing this terrible idea. This short-sighted proposal is nothing more than an attempt to finance tax cuts for the wealthy by selling off our shared heritage. If these lands are privatized, no trespassing signs will go up and we'll never get them back." If the committee passes the version of their mega bill, a vote on public land sales would go to the entire Senate, and then if the bill passes there, to the House of Representatives. Michael Carroll, director of the Bureau of Land Management campaign at the Wilderness Society, said in a statement, "If this becomes law, it could establish a model for members of Congress to liquidate America's lands at any time to pay for their pet projects with little benefit to local communities." Center for Biological Diversity Great Basin Director Patrick Donnelly said, "It's a travesty that Senate Republicans are putting more than 3 million acres of our beloved public lands on the chopping block to sell at fire sale prices to build mega mansions for the ultra-rich. This Senate version is just open season on public lands." The Rowena fire in the Columbia Gorge on the Oregon side of the Columbia River has destroyed an unknown number of homes. The human-caused fire has burned 2,500 acres. Officials reopened Interstate 84 through the gorge today, although a stretch of U.S. Highway 30 through the gorge remains closed. The Wasco County Sheriff's Department issued a new Level 3 evacuation order this morning for areas near the Dalles, adding to Level 3 evacuation orders issued yesterday. The Fire Marshal's agency said it was mobilizing an incident management team and 6 structural task forces. The Oregon Transportation Department closed Interstate 84 yesterday between Hood River and the Dalles. Hood River is a popular tourist destination about 55 miles east of Portland. It's home to about 8,000 people, and about 15,000 people live in the Dalles further east. Officials ordered about 700 people to evacuate in an area northwest of the Dalles along Interstate 84 and further inland. That's according to the Wasco County Sheriff's Department. Officials told about 1,300 people to be prepared to leave on the city's northern end. All of that was yesterday. The Sheriff's Department said officials opened an elementary school as a temporary shelter in the Dalles, while the county fairgrounds would serve as a shelter for livestock and horses. Photos from the Transportation Department showed winds fanning flames alongside Interstate 84. The flames were also burning in the median of the highway. You're listening to the KRFP Evening Report. This is KRFP Moscow Pullman.
June is Pride Month, and Washington's Lavender Rights Project is celebrating with a Black trans comedy showcase. This is the largest fundraiser of the year for the nonprofit, which provides legal and social services for Black trans people. Angel Patterson of Lavender Rights says in the wake of increased attacks on trans rights across the country, the showcase prioritizes the community's health, safety, and joy.
We are your family, too. We are your mothers, your brothers, your sisters, your aunties, uncles, cousins, friends, bosses, coworkers. We're all paying parking tickets and taxes the same as everyone else.
He says the showcase will be on June 14th in Seattle and will feature performers from Washington and across the country, including T.S. Madison and Mix Dahlia Bell. So far, 923 bills targeting trans rights have been introduced across the country this year, and over 100 have passed. Patterson explains that the idea for the showcase came after hearing trans people used as punchlines for jokes in the media.
Instead of a traditional protest, we wanted to reclaim our power in another way that felt sacred to us. And this event is truly that. And it's a wonderful night to bring our folks together and highlight our work and really just feel the power of pride.
The comedy showcase will also have auction items to help raise money for the project, such as plane tickets, glass blowing classes, concert, and sports tickets. I'm Isabel Charlet, Washington News Service.
KRFP thanks its listeners and sponsors, including Tie-Dye Everything, with locally made tie-dyed items, incense, and other accessories. Tie-Dye Everything is located near 6th Street at 527 South Main Street in Moscow. For more information, you can find Tie-Dye Everything at tiedye-everything.com.
Programming on KRFP is also sponsored by Unga Dunga Brewing Company of 333 North Jackson Street in Moscow. Unga Dunga features live music, special events, fine food, and craft beers at hungadungabrewing.com and on Facebook and Instagram.
Idaho lands in the top third of states for child well-being, coming in at 15th in a new national report. The 2025 Kids Count data book from the Annie E. Casey Foundation shows the state making meaningful strides in lowering child poverty and teen birth rates. But it also flags troubling increases in housing costs and the number of uninsured children as indicators that could derail progress if left unaddressed. Leslie Bossier with the Casey Foundation says the country's future depends on how well we support young people now.
Investing in thriving kids is essential to investing in communities, investing in our nation, and investing in a strong economy, because today's kids are tomorrow's workforce.
Bossier explains that reversing educational setbacks is crucial, as nearly 70% of Idaho's 4th and 8th graders are not meeting reading and math benchmarks. She says these trends mirror national data and require strong support for students and educators. The report also finds more Idaho teens aged 16 to 19 are falling off track, with a percentage not in school or working now worse than in 2019. Bossier says states need to rethink how they support young people during these critical years, especially with the rise in disconnected youth.
With things like internships and apprenticeships, stronger and in some cases alternative education, so that they have an opportunity to thrive and to move forward from education and into the workforce.
In addition to education and employment, the report reveals a sharp increase in the number of Idaho children without health insurance. Idaho saw a 40% rise in the number of children without insurance since 2019. That shift, paired with rising family costs, has local advocates urging lawmakers to shore up Medicaid coverage and invest in affordable housing to keep families afloat. Bossier points to Medicaid and similar programs as proven ways to improve children's health outcomes.
I think it's critically important that policymakers look at the data on food security in their community, that they look at the data on access to health care, that they look at what has been effective in driving child well-being.
Despite gains in child poverty reduction, nearly one in three children nationwide lives in households struggling with high housing costs. Advocates say lawmakers have a clear opportunity to act on the data, whether through renewing the state's child tax credit or strengthening protections for low-income families. For Public News Service, I'm Shantia Hudson.
The Washington Employment Security Department said annual average salaries in the state have neared $100,000 a year. The Employment Security Department said in a press release the 2024 statewide average salary rose to $95,160 per year, a 6.8% increase over 2023's average salary of $89,138, a 7% boost in employment plus a 7.5% increase in total wages and salaries drove the salary increase. Wages and salaries statewide have grown to almost $23.5 billion. Average weekly salaries were $1,714 in 2023 compared to $1,830 in 2024. County-specific preliminary data will be unavailable until later this month, which will show how salaries in King County are driving the salary increases across the state. According to the Washington State Standard, department officials said King County yearly salaries averaged $120,000, followed by Spokane County, which averaged almost $79,000. Okanagan County had the lowest average salary at $43,000. Statewide salary averages in 23 counties were less than $60,000 per year. The Employment Security Department said 2024 numbers will be used to calculate minimum and maximum unemployment benefits for new claims opened on or after July 6th. Beginning July 6th, minimum weekly benefits for new claims will go up by $24, raising the minimum weekly benefit to $306. Maximum weekly benefits will increase by $73 to $1,152, calculated to be 63% of the average weekly wage. No single person may receive a weekly benefit amount which exceeds their average weekly salary. And that's it for the KRFP Evening Report for tonight. Taking a look at the weather forecast for the Moscow-Pullman area. Partly cloudy tonight, low 51, 20% chance of showers before noon tomorrow. Mostly sunny, high 74, 20% chance of showers before midnight tomorrow night. Mostly clear, low 44. Sunny Saturday, high 75. And partly cloudy Saturday night and Sunday, low 49, high 78. Currently, we have 75 degrees. If you want to help KRFP keep newscasts like this on the air, plus the newscasts you hear during Morning Mix, the recordings of local events and the public affairs shows, plus the music and arts programming we hear every day here on KRFP, be sure to become a member of KRFP. Memberships are $35 a year, $20 for students and low income. You can mail your memberships to KRFP, 114 East 3rd Street, Moscow, Idaho, 83843, or go to the KRFP website to find out more ways to help KRFP. There's a drop-down box that says Support KRFP. You can underwrite programming, which is a cost-effective way of letting our listeners know your business or nonprofit supports community radio. You can also adopt a DJ. There's a PayPal option and a Patreon button. Once again, we'll gladly accept checks of any amount at KRFP, 114 East 3rd Street, Moscow, Idaho, 83843. I'm Lee Robartis. Brenda Cox and Jim Roach assisted with tonight's newscast. Have a pleasant evening. This is KRFP Moscow Pullman. Flashpoints is up next. At 7:30, we'll have Appearing Locally, where we'll feature music from artists that are appearing in the Moscow Pullman area in the near future. And Kenjim Bites is on the air with his new show in the 8 to 9 slot. Also, the Academy's in 9 to 11 to play music for you in the Not Dark Yet show. And we'll have recorded jam band music concerts with The Ride in the 11 p.m. to 1 a.m. slot. So stay tuned. KRFP Moscow Pullman, community radio for the Palouse at 90.3 on your FM dial and online.
Programming on KRFP is sponsored by listeners like you and by Giant Palouse Earthwork, providing DIY music booking in Moscow and Pullman, focusing on extreme metal, punk, hardcore, and the avant-garde. Giant Palouse Earthworm is available on Instagram, Facebook, or YouTube. Programming on KRFP is also sponsored by Rembrandt Tree Care, family owned and operated since 1977. A conscientious approach to urban forestry with year-round tree service on the Palouse and surrounding areas. You can reach Rembrandt Tree Care at 509-330-0000. 1-800-878-0699.
KRFP thanks all of its donors and underwriters for helping make this programming possible.